I'm going to be talking today with Dr. Henry Wentz. We're going to talk about the Edward Hand Medical Heritage Foundation and the interest they have in preserving the heritage of medicine in Lancaster County. So, Henry, let me ask you first, how did this all get started?
Well, you might say it started in 1799, but that would be a slight exaggeration. I don't know how many of you realize that Lancaster City has the second oldest hospital building in the United States, second only to Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia. And this second oldest hospital building is adjacent to Conestoga View. About 1980, a few of the leaders of the Medical Society got wind that the county commissioners might give up that building. But somewhere along the line, the county commissioners rescinded their offer, and they thought they continued to need the building, and so we never got it. In fact, if you ever tour the building, at least when I toured it about 30 or 35 years ago, there are manacles, iron bands that you put around people's wrists and ankles, and chains attached to the wall or the floor where they kept maniacs and people who they couldn't control because of mental disturbances. Well, as a result of the possibility of having a museum there, a few doctors got interested in collecting medical relics and artifacts with the idea that sometime they would be put in that museum. And so this Edward Hand Medical Heritage Foundation was started. Actually, we started meeting, I think, about 1983 and applied for incorporation to be a tax-exempt organization. And this was finally completed in 1984.
Now, you didn't mention how you chose the name.
That's taken because Edward Hand was a pioneer physician in Lancaster and was an adjutant general to George Washington and practiced for a time before and after the Revolutionary War here in Lancaster. So there were many things being collected, and it was quite an active organization. But as time went on and we never got this building interslag, it became really a dormant organization, and we had no money and no space.
So where was the equipment that you had collected up to that point being kept?
Well, that's interesting. It seemed that at least one director always had a friend who had a warehouse. And so it would be put in a friend's warehouse. And then that friend would need the space for something else. And so we moved to another friend's warehouse. And so we went on down the line until it finally ended up in the General Hospital warehouse.
So is that how the hospital got involved, just as a warehousing facility?
Well, I guess that's the first way it got involved. But it's very interesting. Dr. Ripple and I were invited to a barnstormer.
That's Paul Ripple.
Yeah, Paul Ripple, tarot ophthalmologist. And I were invited to a barnstormer's baseball game as a guest of the Lancaster General Hospital Foundation. I gather this was 2 days after Tom Beaman had been made president and CEO of the hospital. And we had an opportunity to meet him, and we dropped the hint that we had a lot of medical relics on hand and no place to put them. 2 days after he was here, I thought he had so many requests that he would forget all about that. And I was kind of amazed when in the fall, a few months later, Dr. Paul Ripple and I were called into his office along with Jay Booker, and we had about a half-hour discussion. And after the discussion, Tom Beaman said, "Help these gentlemen get started." And so we got started, and very rapidly, they hired a museum consultant, Philip Zimmerman. We already had the storage space. The museum consultant taught us how to take inventory. We had no inventory of these things and taught us how to put them on a computer and then use software that was used by museums to record things. And so we entered all these items. We worked several months entering all these items, taking pictures, taking measurements, trying to record the donor if we knew and who used them and described the instrument or the equipment. And when we were finished, we had over 1,500 items. So that's how we got started. The hospital also gave us the computer, provided the software, and then provided a workroom for us. So they've been very generous in their help to us. And the most important thing, they've given us space, because we had no space, no place to put all this.
How did you develop this exhibit that we have in the hospital now?
Well, the management of the hospital asked us to display the history of the Lancaster General Hospital, which is now about 115 years old. And also, we thought, as well as they, that we should show some preventive medicine. So we asked Alice Schroeder and Rosemary Search to develop a preventive medicine display, which they did, showing the dangers of obesity and smoking and the need for exercise. So that takes up about 20% of the complete display.
What are you looking forward to in the future?
Well, the cardiology display we've been looking forward to for some time, and Bill McCann's been doing a wonderful job with that and has a display ready to go. And the main thing is the space.
I understand you're also planning an exhibit for orthopedics?
That's really on hold. We have an exhibit, and we'll say half ready for orthopedics, but they have not allocated any space for that. And since they built a new building across Duke Street, they're more interested in using space over there. And so they have suggested pulmonary medicine, and Harsh Patel and Dick Weber and Joe Hess have been working on that, and I understand have a good display ready. Another story about the present display, we also show a blood transfusion apparatus that was used when they gave people blood from person to person. There's an interesting story that Bill Hartman told me. Bill Hartman was an obstetrician gynecologist in the mid-20th century. Dr. Charles Stair told him this story, and Dr. Charles Stair was a medical director of this hospital near its beginning. I'm not sure the years, but we'll say 1915. Person-to-person blood transfusions first became available, and they were done in the operating room under the supervision of a surgeon. Dr. Sprague came up from the University of Pennsylvania to talk to the medical society about person-to-person blood transfusion. Transportation wasn't so great in those days, so he came by train, and they stayed overnight and went back by train the next morning. After he completed his lecture of how to do this, he said he would come by the General Hospital the next morning and demonstrate how to give a person-to-person blood transfusion. The doctor in the audience got up and said, "To whom are you going to give a blood transfusion?" And he said, "Well, there's always a person with pernicious anemia lying around." And another doctor got up and said, "We don't have anybody with pernicious anemia in the hospital because we give them all liver worse than they go home." Well, he thought this was some ridiculous remark by a doctor in the boondocks, and so he completely ignored it. And the next morning he showed how to give a person-to-person blood transfusion. He came back to talk about another subject about 10 years later, and he said, "I missed my opportunity for medical immortality by not listening to a doctor here who said we give them liver worse than they go home." Because by that time, Mino and others had discovered that indeed liver did cure pernicious anemia.
Let me ask you about the role of women in medicine in Lancaster County.
150 years ago, practically all doctors had their office in their homes. Most of the doctors in those days were men. So the wife answered the phone when the office was closed, answered the door when somebody came, sometimes cleaned the office, sometimes substituted as a nurse when the doctor needed somebody to accompany him in something he was doing, maybe even did the bookkeeping, etc. And so I like to think of those women as being the first women in medicine, although they were not particularly trained in medicine as we think of it today. And I don't mean to be demeaning about that, because I think women really started in medicine as nurses and physicians, and now we have a lot of women in medicine, in fact, more women than men, I guess, in the family practice residency program. I also had the opportunity of interviewing two women, now deceased, Irene Davis and Mary Ellen Miser Smith, and there were a few other women that practiced in those days, which was in the mid-20th century, such as Dr. Marvel Kirk, who was very busy, and Dr. Wilhelmina Scott, who was a radiologist, and a very good radiologist, and a very compassionate physician. And in those days, they used radium for treatment of cancer of the cervix, and she would go around with her apparatus and insert radium into these people. Mary Ellen Miser said, and I quote her, "There is no doubt about it, women were discriminated against in the late 1800s and denied admission to medical colleges and refused membership in medical societies and internships in hospitals. But gradually, with time, discrimination has disappeared." And she says, "I believe women have the potential to be as good a physician as a man." And she talks about seeing signs of discrimination toward women doctors in the 30s and 40s. Very few men would ever come to her office. But during World War II, when the male doctors went to war, all of a sudden women doctors' practices flourished. I interviewed a number of physicians, about 25 physicians after I retired, and I interviewed Dr. John Farmer. When I entered his home, he took me immediately to the dining area and pulled out a letter written to the president of St. Joseph's Hospital staff by the order of sisters that really ran St. Joseph's Hospital. Mary Bowman, whom I understand was a physician in Mount Joy, applied for admission to the medical staff. After a debate and discussion, the medical staff admitted her to the staff. Shortly thereafter, the president of the staff got this very strong and vehement letter from the sisters, the order of the sisters, that they would not have a woman on the staff of St. Joseph's Hospital. So the doctors, on January the 1st, 1914, walked out, and they took care of the urgent and emergency things and took care of people in the hospital who were in there. But there was no elective admissions or elective surgery or anything done until finally the staff was reorganized by Dr. Newton Baxter. And in 1914, she was denied admission by the sisters. And it's interesting because women were denying staff privileges, not the men.
Well, where do you think you're going to be going in the future with this foundation and all of the collection that you've developed and all the plans you have?
Well, I don't really think there's any end in sight. As long as the hospital is willing to give us space, I think we could develop any area or specialty of medicine with the equipment we have. Obviously, we have many more things in general practitioners' equipment than anybody else, because before World War II, the majority of doctors were general practitioners.
So you really could show the transition of practice over time through the equipment that you've collected.
That's right. Some of the interesting items, we have two letters. One letter was from one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, George Clymer, to Edward Hand. And then another letter we have is from James Buchanan to his physician, Dr. Henry Carpenter, requesting a house visit. I had a very interesting story about this, too. When I was practicing in Strasbourg in the 1960s, this woman came to me, and as I asked her a few questions, she said, "I act just like the granddaughter of a physician, don't I?" And I said, "Why, was your grandfather a doctor?" And she said, "Yes, he was Dr. Henry Carpenter, and he was a personal physician to James Buchanan and Thaddeus Stevens." And when James Buchanan was president and became ill, Dr. Carpenter would go down to the White House and stay with him until he got well, and then he'd come back to Lancaster and practice. But we do have other interesting items. We have a number of bleeding sets, like they used to bleed George Washington. We don't have the set that was used to bleed him, but we do have a number of sets and scarificators, which consist of an instrument with about five knives, and you can set the depth of the incisions you want to make, and you put this over the area desired, and you trigger it, and all these knives pop out at one time. And we also have lancets that were used to bleed, to cut veins.
Well, bleeding was certainly used and overused, and of course there are many who feel that George Washington's death was either caused or certainly accelerated by excessive bleeding.
It was interesting to me, you know, we had mercury in thermometers and mercury in blood pressure apparatus, and today mercury is not permitted anyplace. And as we were thinking about displaying these things, they have to be, what shall we say, encased so
protected from any injury. So I want to thank you very much for coming. It's been an extremely enlightening and informative visit with you, and I'm sure our audience has enjoyed hearing about this.